Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's November 10, 2014, and this is episode 447. Today I welcome Corwin Hibbert back to the podcast. You may know Corwin as the manager to David Duchemin, but he's a man of many hats, one of which he wears as the co-owner of Tandem, a boutique company that offers business management services for creatives. And he's here today to talk about an incredible new product that Tandem has just released, the Business Action Planner. Because this is a recorded interview, there isn't the usual manuscript to go along with this on the blog, but there are links, etc. So if you want to go over to mbp.ac/447, you can get to those links. And you can also jump straight over to the Business Action Planner webpage with the link mbp.ac/BAP for Business Action Planner. Let's jump in now and have a great conversation with Corwin. So welcome back, Corwin. It's been a while since we've spoken, but it's great to have you back on the podcast.
Wonderful. Thank you, Martin.
So Corwin is here today to talk about a new product that he's just released, and I'm very excited about this. It's the Business Action Planner, and this is something that anyone and everyone that is thinking of or already starting a business should be looking into. So I'm really excited to share this with the listeners today.
Very cool. I'm really excited to talk about it. It's one of those things where it's been a labor of love. So the fact that I actually get to talk about it instead of working on it is a real treat.
It must have taken you a long, I mean, I'm not going to ask exactly how much work, but you know, it must have, I can imagine looking at it, that there was a ton of work behind this.
It was, and it's had quite the journey. The business action planning offering used to be a service. Just a few years ago, my wife Eileen and I, we co-own Tandem together. We put this together as a service package, as a consulting offering that we would walk creative freelancers through the business planning process. And in that effort, we realized that we're creating a real monster here, and we thought that this actually could work really good if we make people do it themselves. It'd be a lot cheaper for them, that's for sure. And we realized that people want to work on their business at their own pace, and they want to develop their business ideas, and they want to wrestle with the things they want to wrestle with over a course of time, and that everyone's needs are a little different. So we kind of took basically years of experience in consulting and managing creative freelancers and poured it into the Business Action Planner toolkit and just said, here's everything we could possibly think of when it comes to giving you ideas or helping you make decisions or pointing you in the right direction so that you can actually build a business model that works for you. So yes, it's taken a long time. It's taken years really to build it. But it's been over this last year that we've really put the effort into building the ebook, to building the planning tool, and deciding what worksheets to include out of the gate. And it's been a really great process.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just quoting from your website here. We've got it says there's 40,346 words in the guidebook. There's 344 pages in the guidebook, 188 business action items, and 132 business insights. So, I mean, it just goes to show it's mammoth. But, you know, we'll get into a little bit more about the details. But let's first just tell the listeners a little bit about the format, because I'm really impressed with the way you've done this via Evernote.
Yeah, you know, and that too was also a journey. We've spent a lot of time in our management work. We've spent a lot of time using tools, mostly cloud-based tools that, you know, help us do our work and help us communicate with our clients and help us bring, you know, creative projects, marketing projects, business projects, you know, to completion. And for a while, for the first, you know, three quarters of the business action planning life cycle, it was actually in a matrix, a grid format, a spreadsheet format. We used a tool called Smartsheet, and we had developed it in that tool. And it wasn't until really, I guess, early summer, midsummer, just, you know, a couple months ago, that we really came to fully realize that the business action planning tool needed to be in a little bit more of a note-taking format, one that was a little bit more accessible. I mean, Smartsheet is a great tool, and I'm a huge fan of Smartsheet as a planning tool, but it just was a little too complicated. And, you know, spreadsheets, there's nothing so scary for a creative person to sending them a spreadsheet. And so, you know, we were trying to make it friendly, but ultimately we realized, you know what, we've got to put this in a slightly more, you know, a little bit more, you know, a relaxed format, something that's a little bit more, you know, easier to use. And so as we started to reformat the Business Action Planner for Evernote, we knew that we had just really landed on something for a couple reasons. First of all, a lot of people use Evernote. A lot of people use the free version of Evernote. So it's already on everyone's device. And if they don't have it, there's no cost to get it. So we thought, well, that's great. You know, you basically, I feel like we're selling an app when really all we're selling is an Evernote file that you can upload to your Evernote service. So we knew that we were springboarding off a platform that was already useful. And the primary reason that we did that, actually a lot of reasons, let's see if I can keep this brief. We're trying to change the conversation around business planning. We're trying to, you know, demystify and take the scary out of business planning for creative freelancers. And a lot of people look at business planning as, you know, a very rigid, scary, overwhelming, you know, really intense process that in the end produces a document that either A, gets stuck in a drawer and never sees the light of day, or B, is out of date by the time, you know, it's irrelevant by the time it's done, or it just never gets looked at or used or updated. We think business plans should be always works in progress. We think it should be a snapshot of where you're at and where you're going with your business. And it should be sort of a like a sandbox for you to play and scheme instead of yet again another post-it note journal entry, scrappy note somewhere or an email somewhere, or you know, you're writing on your hand or your wall. Your business plan should all be in one spot. So we knew we wanted a cloud-based, you know, digital environment so that you could work on your plan no matter what device you're looking at, or for the sake of Evernote Moleskine, where you can make a note in your Moleskine, take a picture, upload it to your Evernote, kind of get everything all in one spot. So we knew that we were going to use Evernote. Once we made that decision to use Evernote, we knew we'd landed on something. That's what I meant to say. The second thing about Evernote that's so great is that the experience about business planning, you can, when you take the document out of business planning, it suddenly feels more you. You know, it feels more for you. A business plan can tend to be very, a traditional business plan can feel like you're publishing a document, you know, for, and again, there are some times where a traditional business plan, you know, is very appropriate for, say, submitting to a grant funding or business partners or what have you. But if you're just building it for you, then you got to take the scary out of it. Otherwise, it's just not fun to plan and work on your business.
Yeah, I know that. I mean, my business sort of started organically, and I've kind of stumbled on a number of the things that I've been doing. And so I actually built a business plan probably, let's see, it was more the couple of months just before I incorporated Martin Bailey Photography KK. The KK is like Inc. in other countries. I can tell you, for one thing, I would have loved to have had the business action plan at that point. It would have made the job so much easier and so much less intimidating. But I found that, you know, I actually had the foundations of a business. I'd been doing business as a sole proprietor or sole trader for, what, probably 5 years or so. Before that, so I was kind of hitting the ground running, but still, when I actually sat down, I was going to incorporate my business, and I had to show someone my ideas. It was a very intimidating and scary process, even though I was already running with a lot of the ideas. And so I'm looking through the business action planner this week and just thinking, you know, that the format, I couldn't agree more that Evernote is perfect for this. I've been using Evernote for years. I actually don't have enough data in there that I need to pay for it, but I still pay for the premium just out of respect for the people that made that amazing product. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, this is perfect. The way you've got it, you've put the guidebook in one folder, and then the action items in another one. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, I could be sitting in front of the sofa with my iPad, I could be on the train with my iPhone, or I could be sitting at my laptop or my iMac and actually devoting some time to actually sit down and really work on this. And the format allows me to do all of that. And of course, because it's cloud-based, it syncs between them all. So you get 5 minutes on the train, you can probably sit there and start to work on one action. And then you get home, it's already there, and you can then spend another few hours or a day or so that you put aside to work on more detailed parts. And the system just supports that totally and seamlessly. So I'm really, really impressed with the way you've built this.
Yeah, thank you. And one of the things that we thought was really fun when we really dove into what we were going to do with Evernote is we decided to take the guidebook and also replicate it in Evernote, which so basically we have an Evernote ebook, you know, like it's a, you know, ebook formatted for Evernote. And one of the reasons why we were really excited about that is we thought, well, especially if you think about a lot of people looking on their mobile phones, you know, they're on their phone, and if they're traveling or out away from, you know, the office and they want to read, well, you know, it's very common to just like someone in my position to distribute a PDF ebook, which we did, you know, someone can download the PDF guidebook and there they have it. But it's impossible to read a PDF ebook on a small mobile device. So we thought, you know what, let's take the ebook content, all 44,000 words, let's drop that into an Evernote notebook as well, so that not only can someone work on the planning tool, but if they just want to read, then do it in Evernote. It's nice and simple. So we've had a lot of fun with sort of getting our Evernote on and really enjoying that environment as a way to sort of help people work on their business action plan as well. I just wanted to clarify that for those that are not really game for Evernote and they kind of like it's just a little too much technology for them, or they're not interested or what have you, the guidebook is all inclusive. So like at the end of every section in the guidebook is the business action planning content. You know, you can print that, you can work in PDF. It's not a fillable PDF, but you know, everything's there. There's, you know, and using Evernote's not required. It's just sort of, it's a little bit of the heart and soul of it all, but it's not going to hold you back if someone says, hey, you know, Evernote's just not for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Can we maybe talk a little bit about the relevance of the planner to an established business owner as well? I mean, I know that I would have loved this. Like I say, I'd already got a business going, kind of going by the time I sat down to write a plan. But do you think that there's like an X number of years into a business and this becomes irrelevant, or is it going to be something that doesn't matter how far you are into your business or how many years you are in, it'll still be relevant? What do you think about that, Colin?
That's a great question, Martin. I think the emerging photographer would look at what we've done with the business action planner, and it will give them a very good snapshot of the questions that they need to address over time as they grow what they're going to be doing with their photography business. I think that someone new to the idea of starting a photography business, you know, they need to ask better questions about, you know, where they're going to go with their business and with their career. And so I think it's a really good starting point for really anyone. That being said, the business action planner is very robust and very detailed in the questions that we highlight. And the way that we approach the business plan is sort of, it's really engineered for someone that has already started and is steering a moving ship. You know, for someone, for example, if there's a student who is, you know, they're either young or they're just new to the idea of starting a business and they've never worked with a client yet, then the business action planner is going to be really overwhelming. And, unless they're really dialed into the effort, it's probably a little too much for them. The business action planner is best suited for someone that has already started, whether they've had, you know, one or a few clients, or they've been doing this for a few years and they need to change direction or they need to make some changes. Typically, that's easy to recognize. If they're not happy with their bottom line, and they want to make more money, yeah. or they want to have better clients, or they want to have more clients, and they want to build a legacy as a freelancer instead of it just feeling like a sort of a, you know, sort of on the side. They really want to take it seriously, no matter what level they're at. I believe the Business Action Planner can help them. So it is more for the sort of established and growing, or established and, you know, someone who's really got their foot on the gas or really wants to get there. That's who it's built for. So the newbie, I think they can learn something, and it will prepare them well for the future. But I wrote this from a consulting perspective. I mean, our clients are not startups. Our clients are people who are in demand, that have already a lot of work, and that they need help managing and organizing and making, you know, better business decisions and sort of dealing with volume and dealing with the demand that they have for their business. So that's our wheelhouse. So we built this for photographers that are who are already in the mix. Again, depending on the level, the more sophisticated business owner might look at the business planner and kind of go, you know what, some of these things I've already addressed, I don't need help with that. But some of those items, you know, they will. So they'll be able to just focus on what suits their fancy. It's a choose your own adventure business plan.
Yeah, that's exactly what I felt as I was looking through it. So, I mean, I'm just coming out. We had a half year fiscal year to begin with. I'm actually in the middle of my fifth term at the moment, but in calendar years, I started my company exactly 4 years ago. So we're just entering our fifth year now. And I sat down and started looking through the action, you know, through the guidebook and the action plans. And I, you know, the tasks that you actually fill out, and I'm seeing stuff that I'm going, okay, done that. That's good. It sounds as though I did that right. And then I'm looking at the next one, thinking, you know, I really don't have that in place, and I'm going to have to sit down and work on that. So I think that, and because these are only bite-sized, a lot of them are little bite-sized tasks, I literally was zipping through them and getting comfort from some of the things that I'd done right, and then thinking, okay, I've actually tagged the things that I need to go back to and do. And so, yeah, I mean, even in coming into my fifth year, I found it very interesting and probably very helpful. So I'm actually looking forward to sitting down and starting to work on some of those tasks.
Very cool. That's great to hear.
So when I do these kind of talks, I'd really like to do a five tips section, because this sort of gets us thinking in a structured way as well. So let's can you give us five tips for the listeners at Corwin?
Yeah, you bet. I think that whenever you're looking at your photography business, you always have to distill things down to, like, what's most important? Because, you know, working on your business is not the same as working in your business. So, you know, you always have to focus on, you know, what do you have for your time? Like, how much time do you have to spend on developing your business, and how much money can you afford to dedicate to the things that you need to buy? You know, there's always priorities that you have to make. So I think coming up with five things to focus on, you know, it sounds good to me, because it's the way I like to focus on, you know, let's focus on the big gears. So when I look at business action planning, and I kind of think about, you know, what are the five things that really stand out to me? The first thing, and, you know, no matter what conversation around business planning I have, I always start with this. So it's my rant, if you don't mind.
That's all.
I believe that once your creative niche is solidified, you know, like once your aesthetic and your approach and your style and you kind of feel like your portfolio is starting to really develop, it's at that point that I think that's when your business model should really be shaped. A lot of people like to look to develop their business model, you know, early on in the process. And I think that's one of the great things about a freelance career that sort of develops over time, kind of it spills out of a hobby, and it spills out of a passion. I think once your business model can be, you know, can jump out of the niche that you've established, that's when you can start to say, okay, here's what I do. Here's my work. Well, who can I serve through this work and the way I work? The needs of others have to be at the forefront of any successful business model. So whether you're a service provider or you're in fine art, your photographic work must meet the needs and wants of buyers. And a lot of creative people get started in their work, in their sort of emerging business as, well, I just want to do this more. I hope someone will pay me so I can do more of this. But that's not a business model. That's just, you know, give me money for something that I love. Well, that's cool, but that doesn't meet a marketplace need, right? So with your creative niche and your creative work established, starting to look at shaping your business around the needs of others. So that comes down to, you know, what kind of target audience can I establish? You know, that who do I want to make happy? Who do I want to make their life better? You know, which companies and which organizations that if I were to give them my photographic work or services, that they're going to feel that there's an exchange in value. Without identifying those people and the needs and wants that they have, you're kind of just, you know, have camera, will shoot. And the world does not need more of those. So I think that the first thing I want, I guess this is number one. Number one is to make sure you know the needs of those that you want to serve. And your business has to be service-based, even if it's art. You're still meeting the needs of other people.
Yeah, yeah. You know, as I was listening to you there, I started to recall a conversation that I had with, I don't have permission to quote them, so I'm not going to mention the name, but I was talking with someone a few months ago who's in a position to know a lot about fine art printing and you know, from the manufacturer's side. So I was talking to this guy and we got on to the topic of selling fine art prints, and he said that, you know, a lot of people, what they do, and this is basically what I do as well. We create art for ourselves and then put it out there. And he said that, you know, it's really hard to just sell a print that way because people don't have a, you know, like a reference. A beautiful photograph is not necessarily going to sell just because it's beautiful. And he said, he gave me a story about one guy that he knew that was traveling around the US, going to art fairs and even like craft shows and things in local malls, shopping malls and stuff. And he said that he was happy, but not totally happy with his sales. And then what he did was, instead of turning up the day before the event and setting up and then just hoping things would sell, he would actually arrive there a week before. And then he'd spend that the 5 days before the weekend or before the show actually shooting in the area. And he set himself up with the following year, say, if it was a yearly thing, he'd go back. And then he'd have photos from the area and probably a lot of the time from that season as well. And what he would do is, in addition to the prints that he made for, you know, just of his own beautiful fine art, he was making prints of local scenes, and all of a sudden his sales rocketed and people were turning up. I mean, it's not necessarily selling to art collectors. He's selling to families in the shopping mall and, or people at art fair. And they all were responded so much better to photographs of their local countryside or, you know, tourist spots in their local area. And so, you know, basically what he'd done was he'd given himself put himself in a position where he could shoot more, and he wasn't necessarily making the work that he really wanted to, as regards to his fine artwork. Apparently he was still making beautiful work, but he was catering to the needs of the people that he was trying to sell to. So that really just plays into exactly what you were saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that's a great point. And there's always that battle, that challenge, you know, connecting your passion to the needs of your clients. And, you know, sometimes there's a total fit and sometimes there isn't. I think that, you know, if once your style and your niche is established, you can tweak from there. You can find those little elements that you need to adjust in order to generate money. And, you know, for those that don't want to compromise their style or their subject matter or what have you, that's okay. It has a financial repercussion. It might mean that you have to work at a coffee shop in order to supplement your business. That's a decision you can make. But it really does come down to making sure that, you know, what you're offering is of value to those you're trying to get money from. Otherwise, you're just, you know, yet another person with a camera. So, Well, okay. Well, I guess I'm supposed to give you a list here. So number two,
okay.
Number two is, is really around developing a brand experience that's anchored more around trust and generosity, not just visual treatments. What I mean by that is a lot of photographers that are looking to establish their business within the marketplace, they do that by creating visual treatments like logos and, you know, color palettes and websites and business cards and portfolios and all that great stuff that helps communicate your brand. But as a freelancer, your brand is really you, because what a brand is a brand is an extension of it, it is a conversation around trust. And a buyer is not buying from a company, even if you're incorporated, if you're the sole owner. It's really about you. So your brand is really what people experience when they connect with you. So that's how you communicate online. That's what you say online. That's who you direct your comments to. That's your, you know, your extension, your personality, your character. A lot of people look at their brand as simply a logo or some other iteration of their visual marketing collateral. But a brand is a trust factor with the owner. So I like to encourage people, like, for example, if someone really wants to take their networking, you know, up a notch, well, try networking without a business card. Because, for example, what a business card does is it helps make those, you know, if your exchange is brief, it helps you remember who that person is and you swapping details. I'm sorry, if you can remember their name and who they work for or where they, like, that's more valuable than whether you trade the business cards with them. It's it's the type of rapport you build with someone. So, you know, taking your branding efforts and putting it into the, as an owner, how am I going to act? How am I going to be? You know, what things can I do and say that instill confidence and trust? That matters more. And then ultimately, how can you go above and beyond the call of duty and really give people that wow experience? That's a brand.
Yeah. You know, I when I started doing this podcast, obviously I had a big decision there. I mean, I called it the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. And there's partly, part of that reason is because it was going to be about, talking people through processes as I made my own images and, you know, using real world examples with my, of my own work. Now, there was a conscious decision at that point. I was already doing the occasional assignment. I was selling a few prints here and there. And I was starting to build a brand, and the brand was basically me. And it felt a little bit uncomfortable, and I'm sure I still lose possible listeners to the fact that, you know, I'm not going to sit and listen to him talk about himself, but that's not what it's about. That's never what it's been about. But it is about the brand of me and my work and how I, you know, interact with others. And what I wanted to quickly say here before we move on to your third point is that this to me, again, I looked at the planner, and you've got a section there about using a business name or your name as the business. And when I first saw that, I thought, oh no, I've done something wrong. But then you do go into how it can work both ways. And I totally agree that, you know, if you're working as a, even though I've incorporated, I've got a KK on the end now, it's still about, you know, the brand is still me. And that can be a little bit uncomfortable, but I think a lot of photographers do that because it's, you know, you are the brand. So it's great to actually hear that that's kind of okay.
Oh, it definitely is, for sure. And I think that, when it comes to, dispensing consulting advice without any context, I encourage photographers to err on the side of naming their business, you know, after themselves, because I think that's more genuine. And that ultimately, unless your target audience would benefit from some sort of, you know, business name that is, you know, a little different, or it helps communicate your style and aesthetic, then go with your personal name, because that would be a better fit. I think that a photographer needs to have a very good reason to establish a business name other than their own, in order to connect with their audience. Otherwise, I think they're just creating a little extra barrier to building trust.
Yeah, that's good to know. So give us number three there, Colin.
All right. So number three, this is a bit of a bias on my end, but I see a lot of freelancers create for themselves a lot of mess, a lot of chaos around not only the business and what they do, but also around the creative end. So I think removing chaos from the creative administrative workflow, even if your freelance business is, you know, small and on the side, you can still be a professional. And, you know, a lot of people like to have, you know, going pro or turning pro conversations. And I hate those conversations. I hate them so much because professionalism does not require a full-time gig. Yeah. You can be a professional. You can act in a professional way. You can conduct your business professionally, even if you have one client. Mm. It's really about, you know, take the mess out, get rid of the piles, get rid of the scary inboxes, get rid of the scary, you know, folders and don't have a messy Lightroom and don't have invoices with the wrong invoice numbers. And, you know, just take time to do a little bit of administration once in a while so that you can be less stressed. I mean, ultimately, if you remove chaos and mystery from your creative workflow and from your administration, you will have more mental energy to be creative. You will have more mental energy to be a better listener when hearing the needs of your potential buyers. I mean, there's so many benefits to removing the stress from doing the work that you love. And there's a bit of a creative people get pigeonholed around them being sort of, you know, they're always late or they're messy or they're disorganized. If you want to, if you really want to make a mark in your niche and in your target market, my goodness, be organized and be on time and, you know, like just put a little extra effort into that because the freedom that you will experience will really benefit. Your life will become richer as you remove some of that chaos and mystery. So I think that's one of the things that's a big gear that a lot of creative people kind of go, oh, well, I'll get organized on the weekend or later or not now. It's more important than I think a lot of people realize in that it affects their creative spirit. It affects their legacy. I mean, a lot of creative people, when they look back on years of creative work, they wish that they were more organized and less stressed about every point of each project or each effort. So that's something I'd like to encourage people to do.
You know, you touched on a number of things there that I've just got to jump in on again. So about the pro thing, when I first incorporated my company, I made the mistake of saying that I've gone pro, but that really led to the first comment I got back from that from a great friend, Landon Michelson, and he said, "No, Martin, you've always been pro. It's just now you do it for a living," and I, you know, like you, meaning you've always done professional work. And I felt that was such a beautiful comment to receive, but it really put things into perspective. You know, I mean, I pride myself on doing a quality job, and I've done that for, you know, as many years as I can remember. And it was really just about actually making it all I do. So a lot of the time now, rather than calling myself a professional photographer, I call myself a full-time photographer because that's what I do now. But the other thing that I was thinking about there was you also talked about the administrative workflow, and I mean that's huge. I spend a lot of time on various things because I'm basically a one-man band. My wife works for the company as well, but because she doesn't really use computers, a lot of the stuff that she does, she's a great photography assistant. You know, she's great with my studio lighting and stuff like that, and she also helps with a lot of the analog back office stuff, like sorting out receipts and things. But apart from that, it's basically a one-man band at the moment. So what I did was I spent a couple of months last year building redid my website and put WooCommerce on the background, and that allows me to basically automatically digitize a lot of the orders that we get. And now, even if for example for tours, when I start to take payments for tours, even if someone's going to send me a bank transfer to pay for the tour rather than paying by credit card, it still goes through the website, and then they get an email that gives them all of the bank details. So that not only saves me from having to, you know, go and copy and paste those, it also enables me to, as you touched on, it means all of our invoice numbers are all in, you know, all managed properly because the system just looks after all of that. And so it's made everything, a lot of the back office, really smooth. The problem for me, and this is the double-edged sword sort of statement here, is that because I've got a technical background, and because we're still relatively young as a company, I end up doing a lot of that stuff myself. And so I can spend months working on that sort of stuff. And I feel more like a web designer or a web admin sometimes than a photographer. And so I kind of wish that we'd got someone else that I could ask to do that, or even had enough income coming in to outsource a lot of that. But, you know, that's kind of, you know, going off the rails a little bit in my own personal experience.
You spoke to the fact that, you know, independent business owners have to wear a lot of hats, you know, and, you know, you can wear less hats if you're willing to pay for and you put your trust in someone else to do that. Mm. But that cost to business, you know, it doesn't always make sense. So sometimes like you said, you worked on a website for months. Well, had you paid someone to do it, it might have taken 2-3 weeks, right?
Yeah.
And maybe it would have happened a lot faster, but you would have paid a premium likely to make that happen.
Yeah.
And you would have had to relinquish some control at some point. So, you know, the realities of independent business ownership are you figure it out, you take the time, you know, and though it's an investment, it's one that you can afford. And you know, it's a very common environment. Now down the road, I mean, your website, I don't know how many iterations your website's gone through in 5 years, but my guess is it's been through a few. Mm. And you know, it will change in the future, but maybe next time you're now going to be a more educated buyer of website services, right?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
You've kind of been there, done that. You know, this isn't your first rodeo, and you're going to make a better decision around who you're going to hire and what they're going to do and what you're responsible for. So it is a journey, and you know, and not everything is from behind the camera.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. And a lot of the time you mentioned there about the trust and handing over the, you know, I forgot the word you used, but you know, it's so true. I mean, I was talking with my wife a few days ago, and we were actually talking about you and David's relationship and how I would love to have not either a manager or even just an assistant, someone that we hired to help out with a lot of this work. So to free me up to do a lot of the work, the more creative work that I really need to get to. And my problem at the moment is that I'm, to a degree, I'm kind of in a vacuum because we work in Tokyo. There's people all around us. It's one of the biggest cities in the world. And yet I don't really, at the moment, with the way things are set up, I don't really have the time to even get out and network. And so all of the people that I come into contact with are remote, and that may well be a perfect way to do this, but I also need to build trust with someone. And even if I was going to hire someone as an assistant that lived on the other side of the world, I need to find someone that I can trust enough to basically give the passwords to the website and to, you know, to actually pay someone to do a job that I'm not sitting looking over them and being able to check that they actually are working 8 hours a day or stuff like that. And even if it's necessary to work 8 hours a day, you know, if they can get the job that I need to done in half that, get done in half of that, they're still going to get the same amount of money. And so, you know, it's a lot of the time taking that step and actually getting someone on board or trusting that kind of work, it does take a lot of work to actually get to the point to trust people. And that's really one of the next steps that I need to do, is to start to really put myself into a position where I can find someone to entrust with some of that work.
Yeah, outsourcing and adding to your, you know, to your crew is not an easy decision to make. And trust is the primary factor. Mm. So it's one of those things where, you know, it's a journey. And, you know, a lot of people experiment with those efforts, usually unsuccessfully. Mm. It's hard to do. It's not easily done. Mm. But I think it's, you know, the business owner, that's the fight, right? As soon as you can start having other people do some of the work, you actually start being a real business owner versus just someone that works in your business. Mm. And that is a, you know, not it's one of those things where the decision to involve someone outside of, you know, you or your home, you know, sort of your more personal life to get involved with your business is one where you kind of have to be able to have the level of demand in your work and the cash flow to justify it so that you can build up your efforts with them and not just dump, you know, you don't want to pull a pin on a grenade and throw it at a perfect stranger that you hope does a good job for you because there's just too much on the line. So, no, it definitely, it's a that's a hard decision for sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm lucky.
Well, I'll make my last couple points here if that's okay.
Okay, go on then, yeah.
That's right, yeah. I just wanted to, because just realized that I had two more points. I mean, you gave me five. That's a lot of homework, man. But I did my homework, Martin. I did my homework. I wanted to highlight the sales process that a lot of freelancers kind of take for granted. They kind of just think that their charm and their body of work will do all, you know, everything they need for them. I think that there's a lot of mystery associated with this, with the selling process that a freelancer has. And I think that buyers are typically very confused about how to evaluate a project, how to get a quote from a freelancer, how to establish sort of the pricing and, you know, the value. So I think whether it's a starting point might be packaging, you know, wedding photographers typically, based on the market, have to create packages with pricing that's established and sort of they tweak from there. I think a lot of photographers would benefit from looking at the wedding industry and kind of going, okay, well, if a wedding photographer, you know, can be successful with establishing packages and package pricing, then what can I do with my services to identify what I'm going to do and how much that's worth? And how can I move someone to the point of, hey, I'm interested, to them being an actual client? So documenting the sales process and knowing more about the process of getting someone to becoming a client, that's time and energy well spent as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. I think that it really is so important. And I, you know, I see you touch on this in your next top point as well. So I won't sort of start going off on my own little monologue here. But yeah, that's so important.
The money part is always the tough one, you know, and feel like a lot of people want to talk to me about money. Probably the question I get asked the most is, you know, how much should I charge?
Yeah.
That's the question I get from photographers over any other question. I get asked a lot of questions. That one is always top of the list. You know, Corwin, how much should I charge? And I'm a huge fan of John Harrington's rant on, you know, what's wrong with day rates and, you know, why deliverable-based costing makes a lot more sense for a service provider like a photographer. Now, of course, there are exceptions to that, but I think the conversation around money is always best had when, and this is my fourth point. You like how I segue?
Yeah, you know, go transition for it.
I think that conversation around pricing and money, it's got to be rooted in a freelancer's intimacy with their cost of living and their cost of business. A business owner, like an incorporated business owner with brick and mortar and, you know, shareholders or stakeholders, blah, 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 all the big business stuff, they don't have this problem. But a freelancer has rent, has hydro, has, you know, utilities, has medical expenses and groceries and car payments. Oh, and there's some photography expenses and income as a part of that. No matter the legal separation, if you spend all the money you make, then your cost of living and your cost of business really should be merged. So from a budgeting standpoint, one of the reasons why in the Business Action Planner Toolkit, we put in some budgeting worksheets. We did that because we wanted a freelancer to say, okay, here's my life, here's my income, here's my lifestyle, here's my domestic household, you know, picture. And when I add business expenses and business revenue into that scene, here's what it looks like on a monthly basis. You have to have that set. You cannot be worried if your credit card or debit card is going to, you know, get declined at a coffee meeting with a potential client. You can't be worried about your next bill. I mean, you might be worried about them, but you had better know what's coming, what's coming in, what's coming out, when those things happen, and have some forethought about what's happening next month, the next quarter. That's what good business owners do. So I think a freelancer that can establish those those things can make better decisions about their money now and better decisions about their pricing and sort of the revenue stuff later on, or at least with that information in. I always get a kick out of people that want to create pricing based on what they need financially. The reason why I'm concerned about that is that, for example, one process of establishing a price is, well, I want to make $80,000 a year, and if I work three jobs a month, you know, divide this, and I need to charge $3,000 per shoot. All right, that is one way you can come up with it. But what happens by month two, you haven't had any work or not enough work to meet that paradigm? Are you going to then increase your pricing for all future gigs to accommodate? Of course not. Ultimately, the marketplace has some limits, some range that they can comprehend. And the most important factor about setting a price, I'm going on a rant now.
Go for it.
One of the important things about setting a price is that a freelancer has to be able to say the number, the amount that they're going to charge, and they have to say it with confidence.
Absolutely, yeah.
If a freelancer says, I'm $1,000 a month, and instead of shutting up at that point, they kind of try to justify it or even negotiate themselves down, which I hear all the time, it just means it's a fake number. It's not a real number. So I think being able to set a price that like a baseline, they can kind of go, you know what, this is my price, take it or leave it. That's the best position a freelancer can be in. So whether it's budgeting or cash flow or setting prices, removing the mystery around money is really important. That's why I really love David Duchemin's book, How to Feed a Starving Artist, because it just breaks down some of the barriers that creative people have around talking about money. And it's important to be able to get more comfortable with the conversation around money so you can focus on being creative. Money is a part of business. Money is the language of business.
Right.
Maybe legalese is too, but money is important. So
absolutely.
I just wanted to highlight that.
No, and that's why I wanted to move on to this tip before I said what I was going to say. But I find that, I get asked a lot. I mean, I do consulting as well as the business, the photography side. And I mean, it's all part of the same business. And one of the things that I get asked a lot is about how to price. And you touched on everything there that I normally say. And the problem that I hear a lot is people start out and they say, well, I'm going to do a few gigs for free to get started. And that's fine if you are, if you never actually want to get paid. But I always say to people, if you're going to be using these, you're already obviously at a point where you're confident enough to take jobs. And if you're confident enough to take jobs, you need to be confident enough to talk about how much it's going to cost to do that job. And so many people put that off because they're scared of the conversation. And you've really got to be able to sit down and say, okay, yeah, sure, I'll do this for you, and these are my costs. And you need to have the prices and the costs ready. You can't have that start to try and throw these numbers around in your head before as you sit down for that conversation. I many years ago I sat down. I forget the book I read that helped me with this, but I bought a book about it, and it basically led me through the whole process. And I just sat down and listed everything that I need to pay each year. And then I worked down to where I got a day rate. And it turned out that day rate is a very reasonable, not too expensive, not too cheap sort of day rate in the business. And I've been paid that day rate many times. But what you also touched on there as well is I turned down more jobs than I take. And I have basically two day rates that I use. One is for assignment work, and that's where I go onto a location and do photography for someone for a day. And then I need to come back and then charge them for the post-processing, which is something that people don't do a lot. And I've got another day rate that's basically for private tours. And sometimes people email me and say, Martin, we'd love to do a private tour. For example, they want to go to the Snow Monkeys for a few days. And I know exactly how much that's going to cost. So I can just email them straight back, or if we've Skyped, I can tell them straight away that it's going to cost them X amount per day. Now, I say that with confidence because I know that's how much I charge. That's not, I know that's how much I'm able to charge. And then some people will say, well, you know, that's a little bit on the high side. And I'll say, okay, well then please go and find someone else that can do the job. And they either walk away or they come to terms with the fact that that's how much it's going to cost. And then they're very happy with the end product because I actually over deliver on the, on what they expected to get for that money. But I literally, I mean, for assignment work, for tours and things like that, I would much rather let people walk away than start to feel uncomfortable with the amount of money that it's going to charge them. You know, I don't want to work for people that don't understand my value. And so, you know, all of that really comes from, as you've just touched on, understanding your costs, understanding how much you need to charge per day, and being confident when you deliver those figures. And I think that that's something that mm-hmm. so many people getting started out really aren't able to do, and it's so important.
Well, let me spring. See, I'm going to rant off your rant.
Go for
on this one, because I think it's really important, and I think pricing is one of those conversations that a lot of people don't have in a tangible way. So I'm excited that you're jumping into this one. So the first thing is you talked about free and working for free. And I spent a lot of time teaching business and marketing to student photographers. Mm. You know, typically they're young, they're fresh out of high school, and they're learning the craft of photography, and they want to start a photography business in the near future. Mm. And so they're going through the academic exercise of creating a pricing model that, you know, makes good business sense. Mm. And of course, in that process, they typically end up establishing a price that there's no chance they'll be able to charge that rate right out of school, you know? Mm. Like, from the moment they graduate, they're going to have to compromise on that price for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
And if they're, you know, mature about it, they'll recognize that, you know, the rate that they've decided on, they have to earn that rate. Mm. And that rate comes with experience and with time and with rapport and trust and, you know, the proof's in the pudding, right? So you get there. The second thing about free, the first thing about the free part is that free only works when it meets a marketing need. It is not a way to establish a pricing model. So if you've identified ahead of time, hey, these types of jobs, these types of gigs, I should say, you know, I might be willing to do these for free or really, really cheap because I believe I can make use of it from a marketing standpoint, then great. Then when that opportunity comes to you or you pursue it, you know that there's a marketing benefit. No problem. There's an exchange in value, right? Great.
Yeah.
It's when someone comes to you and they try to convince you of a reason why you should work for them for free, then that's just bogus. And that's not a great way to establish things. Because like you kind of intimated, you know, if you come out of the gate with free, then really all you're communicating is that you're free.
Exactly.
You know, there's not a whole lot of value there. So it has to be pre-planned, predetermined, and then you kind of fit from there. And that you have your marketing objectives clear. Otherwise, it's kind of just you're kind of getting used, or you're allowing yourself to be abused as a photographer. So that's pretty dangerous. Mm. The other thing I wanted to jump on when it comes to establishing your price is you have to have a walk away number. You have to have a number that if someone wants to go below, you can say, like you just said, hey, you know what? I'm sorry, you're going to have to go somewhere else. Oh, of course, you want to find, you know, friendly ways to say it, but you kind of have to cut someone loose if they go below that baseline number. Mm. When it comes to the negotiating part, what a lot of photographers do is that if they need the money, you know, like sometimes you just need a paycheck because we all need money. If you just need a paycheck and you have to compromise on your base price, then you had better find ways to change the scope, right? The scope of your work, the number of final images you offer, the number of images you edit, the amount of time you spend on site, or you insert, you know, situation or logistics here. Find ways to make it easier or fit better with your lifestyle or fit better with your calendar or some compromise so that you can say to yourself, okay, I'm going to make less money, but I'm going to at least make it a little bit more enjoyable or a better fit for me.
Yeah.
So there's got to be some understanding. That's where the value exchange is clear.
Right.
When it's not, okay, well, this is my price. You want to talk me down? No problem. You know, I'm going to give you three final images, not 10, or I'm not going to give you a hard drive of images. I'm going to send you 4 and you're just going to have to pay for the rest, yeah, or what have you.
Yeah. Yeah. So true. People really need to get a lot of this stuff into their, especially when they're starting out, they need to get it into their plan.
Totally. I totally lost count of how many tips I have, but one other thing I wanted to mention, if it's okay, is the marketing effort that goes into a photography business. It's one of those things where a lot of people kind of want to create a portfolio and hope that their work speaks for itself. Mm. And while that's, I think most, especially those freelancers that have kind of been doing it for a while, I think they realize that, hey, it's not quite like that. It's not, you know, put an image on Facebook and get a phone call the next day. Like, it's, you know, marketing your photography work is difficult. I see a lot of photographers trying to stand above the crowd and kind of stand out in the crowd and make more noise or share more photographs or kind of just, you know, crane and strive and really try to, you know, outfight their competitors. Mm. I think that's a very dangerous approach to have when trying to make your business more marketable. I think curiosity is what actually drives demand. I think you make your target audience interested in who you are, what you do, and what you photograph and how you photograph it. It will make you more interesting. It will make you more appealing. They will be more interested in how you can meet their needs. And I think drawing a crowd, it can even be small, is more beneficial than trying to stand out in one. So I know that sounds a little bit like a bumper sticker, probably not a very good one. But I think that those photographers that are building a small, loyal, committed audience, whether it's a fan base or a small circle of clients, you know, going deeper with the clients you have, meeting more needs and finding other ways to offer creative services and creative work and visual efforts that, as an artist, you know, you're contributing to multiple needs. Going deep with fewer clients is always better. It's a better way to sell. And then doing things, if it's a personal project or a collaborative project, doing the things that make people notice your skill and your, you know, your vision and your, those things are what inspire people. So everyone needs to stop making so much noise. I think people need to spend more time thinking, what can I do that connects my passion with the entertainment factor of others? Like, what do people really want to watch and look at and see and experience visually? That's what draws people to you, not just, you know, how many Facebook ads can you pound out, or how, you know, I hope my mom really likes my picture on Facebook to kind of get things started.
Excellent.
that rant requires alcohol for me to go down that one anyway.
Okay, well, we'll save the rest of that conversation to when I finally get over to Canada and bring a bottle of wine around.
That'd be great. Or maybe we do a business workshop with the Snow Monkeys one time.
Oh, that would be amazing. Yeah, yeah. Well, I would love to see you over here in Japan as well. So we'll maybe be able to make that happen at some point. So Corwin, we're coming up on an hour. It's been an incredible conversation and I don't want to take much more of your time. So, let's start to wrap it up. Where can people go to find the Business Action Planner?
Yeah. Good thing I got the domain I wanted. Yeah. BusinessActionPlanner.com is where people can find the toolkit, and we have the toolkit for photographers. In a couple of weeks, we'll be launching the toolkit for graphic designers. But right now, it's the BusinessActionPlanner.com website. That's the home base for everything. And our company, Tandem Agency Incorporated, we're the publishers and authors of it. But everything's at BusinessActionPlanner.com. And there's lots of detail there around, including screenshots and other, you know, collateral to help someone understand what is involved in this toolkit. But it's all there at BusinessActionPlanner.com.
Excellent. I guess that, you know, people go over there, they can get in touch with you about the planner and everything as well.
Yeah, you bet. All the links come straight through to me and my team.
Excellent. Well, it's been a pleasure and a great educational conversation as well. So it's always nice to talk with you, Corwin. But let's wrap it up there for today.
Awesome. Thanks, Mark.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye bye.
Take care. Bye bye.
Wow, what a great conversation. I hope you enjoyed that. So We've actually set up an affiliate system. I believe in the Business Action Planner so much that, you know, I'm going to be promoting it as well. So if you want to help support this podcast and the Martin Bailey Photography website, then use the link mbp.ac/BAP when you go over to buy that, and you'll be helping us out. And before we finish, I forgot to mention something last week that I should have done. At the end of the final part of our Iceland travelogue, I had actually just updated, we'd drawn a winner for the fine art print giveaway that I do every few months. And I actually, the image that I showed you of the deep glacial ice looking like a jewel in the midst of some larger icebergs, I'm going to give that away on December 25th, Christmas Day. So if you'd like to be in with a chance of winning a 17 by 24 inch fine art print of that photograph, then go to mbp.ac/giveaway, and you just have to sign up for our newsletter. Once we've drawn the winner, I will alert the whole group via that newsletter, and then your name will be added into our general newsletter. If you have already entered for a previous giveaway, there's no problem. You can enter again, and your name will only, of course, go into the general newsletter once, so you won't receive multiple emails or anything like that. And we don't spam. You'll basically get an email every so often, and you can always unsubscribe if you decide you don't like that, to get that later. So giveaway draw will be on, it finishes on December 24th. I'm going to let that run over a little bit to my 25th so that we can get the time zones in, and then I'll email and let the lucky winner know who they are, and we'll start another draw, probably run through into February or the end of February time. Okay, well, thanks very much for listening today. If you enjoy this podcast, please share a link with your friends. And if you don't already, please subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcast program to ensure uninterrupted delivery. You can find me on Google+, Twitter, and Facebook, and links to everything that I'm up to are at martinbaileyphotography.com, so do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week with another episode. But in the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.